He said, "We mean you no harm. We wish you only happiness." And I told him my name, and when I told him my name, he said he was called Cole.
Cryptid Code. We're your hosts, Harmon
and Jessica,
and we like to talk about cryptids, aliens, and generally anything spooky.
And we cuss a fuck ton.
Indeed. And today we are continuing our deep dive into the Mothman mystery. Last episode we established kind of the foundation of the story, the first few encounters with the cryptid, and some important figures. Now we'll be further exploring more Mothman sightings, introducing some of the elements surrounding the general strangeness in Point Pleasant. Before we continue, though, I did want to make some corrections. Last episode, I said Roger's car was a 1947 Chevrolet. That's incorrect. It was actually a 1957. And Jake, in case you're listening to this, I've consulted people. Cars back then could go 100 miles. You just had to remove the governor. That means nothing to you, Jess, but... Jess doesn't listen to other episodes.
Okay, I've been on hiatus. I've been going through some shit, dude.
Yeah, which I guess we might as well take that out, get out of the way of now. If you might be wondering why the original crew isn't here. Work. Our schedules are incompatible.
Completely and utterly incompatible.
I did the math. I'm working like over 50 hours a week.
Same.
I won't say where, but... Because I ain't catching a defamation case. But yeah, it was either record with just Jess and sadly have to exclude the original cast, or just simply it'll be forever before we get another Mothman episode, and I figured I can't leave y'all hanging that long. But with that out of the way, join us for part two of the Mothman saga titled Cold Case. Now, last we left off, John Keel had just arrived to the small town of Point Pleasant, possibly encountering the Mothman and discovered a strange zone of fear within the TNT area. Partnered with local reporter Mary Heyer and forming connections with a tight-knit group of witnesses, John Keel would spend the next year uncovering a long-reaching mystery that still baffles and unsettles researchers today. But as his investigations were just beginning, more signs of the Mothman were pouring in. A particularly frightening account would come from 14-year-old Faye DeWitt Laporte one November night, who was returning home from a drive-in theater. With her were her brother Carlisle, age 16, who was driving...
Carlisle? Sorry.
Is that a reference to something?
Twilight.
The very topical and relevant Twilight that all the kids know, along with her younger siblings, Betty, Ray, and Jack. Said theater was across the river on the Ohio side, and the route back home led them along the TNT area. Naturally, the younger children began to discuss the recent talk of a monster dwelling within the earth-shrouded bunkers. Being the oldest, Carlisle was too mature to believe in monsters. Probably just someone in a Halloween costume, jumping out to scare dumb kids. I don't know why Carlisle, age 16, sounds like a middle-aged balding construction worker, but I can only do five voices. Nuh-uh, one of the kids protested. The paper said it's real, Carlisle smirked. There's nothing to be afraid of. Here, I'll prove it. And with that, he turned off into the TNT area. They drove through the TNT area for a bit before happening upon the creature's stomping grounds, the North Power Plant. Hearing all the stories of witnesses spotting the Mothman overhead, the kids were sure to keep their eyes on the sky. They scanned every branch and studied every shadow, but they were too busy looking up to see what was right next to them. Faye was the first to see it. She just so happened to glance out the passenger side window and saw a shadowy figure running alongside the car. At first, she thought it was a reflection of her brother, just a trick of the light. It was until this figure turned to face her, revealing a pair of glowing red eyes. She would describe the creature as, quote, it had no beak, It had a feature just like a face. It had a little nub for a nose with a little bridge that stuck out. You could see its nostrils. It had a mouth, but if it had any teeth, I never saw them. Its head was shaped like a human's head, but it was all in like feathers, surrounded by them, like a dog or a cat, end quote. I don't know what the fuck that means.
I don't know.
Apparently it looks really weird, which is the general gist, I suppose.
I guess. I don't know. I feel like this is weird. Mothman is one of the very few cryptids where people actually, like, instead of just having experiences with him, like, people hunted him. Like, people went out looking for him consistently. Like, I don't know. They couldn't leave that poor fucking moth alone.
It's also weird to see a Mothman running.
Right. Like, why not fly? Like, he has wings. Just yeah. Fly away. Hit the lamp, you know?
Hit the lamp.
Hit the lamp.
You sound like a disapproving gym coach. Ah, Mothman, hit the lamp!
I mean, I just feel like, you know, he's a moth. He's gonna boom into a lamp.
Boonk.
Boonk.
Boonk. Face screen for Carlisle to drive faster. Meanwhile, Betty, being a good older sibling, covered Jack and Ray's eyes, shielding them from the terrifying sight just beyond their windows. As they neared the power plant, Carlisle took a turn too hard and the car went into a skid, stopping them dead in their tracks. The Mothman hopped onto the windshield, staring directly into Carlisle and Faye's eyes. Jack and Ray were lucky not to see it. Before they could react, the creature dropped onto the ground and in a single bound jumped onto the roof of the power plant. Faye was very specific that it jumped instead of flew. Like a massive bird, it perched on the ledge of the building and simply observed the witnesses. Carlisle was the first to recover and shake off the fear. Then he did something that just frankly baffles me. Really just going for that Darwin Award. Carlisle got out of the car, looked at the dark, almost angelic creature before him, and threw a fucking rock at it.
What?
You just threw a rock at it. You went full caveman. Just
what the fuck? Leave the poor moth alone. Also, I feel like potential explanation for Mothman. What if it's just a billionaire in a moth suit who was, like, really obsessed with Batman? He's like, oh, let me come up with something. Yeah.
Mothman. I don't think he fights crime, though.
No, I don't think so either. I think he's just a billionaire who, like, wants to piss people off. He's like, let me jump my little mothy ass around.
How do you think he's growing up with a car, then?
I don't know. Double-cheeked up on a Thursday afternoon.
Please stop. Mothman watched, apparently just as confused as the rest of us, as the first few stones missed it. So it wasn't one mistake, it was multiple mistakes. He's dedicated to this.
He's pelting him with rocks, but missing.
Yeah, he made this decision. A single stone managed to hit Mothman's foot, prompting him to slowly stand up. Realizing he'd done fucked up, Carlisle made a desperate dash for the car. Behind him, he could hear the loud thud of the creature hitting the ground. His quickened footsteps pattered behind him, kicking up dust as it got closer and closer. Carlisle nearly jumped into the driver's seat and slammed the door shut. The Mothman, however, ran right past the car. According to the witnesses, it ran towards some of the hedges standing 6 feet tall, leapt over them, and unfolded its wings mid-air before flying off into the night.
Okay, so he ran past the car. So I feel like that's a pretty good indication they had turned the headlights off.
Oh my god. You're on this, aren't you?
I really am.
Deputy Halstead was present at the local courthouse when this carload of frightened children came running in. They were clearly freaked out and their fear was genuine. When he finally calmed them down, Carlisle explained that he was wrong. There was something to be afraid of. Another sighting came on November. Fuck.
You okay?
No.
You gonna make it?
I don't think so.
Oh boy.
Another sighting came on December 4th, around 3 p.m., as a strange bird-like creature was seen by a group of pilots consisting of Henry Upton, Leo Edwards, Ernie Thompson, Eddie Atkins, and Everett Wedge. What?
I don't know. Wedge. It's just a weird name. Everett Wedge.
All of our Wedge fans.
He sounds like a supervillain.
I'm subscribing, right? Everett Wedge?
Everett Wedge.
Fuck, he does sound like a supervillain. That sounds like a Bond villain.
Yeah.
Anyway, they saw what they first assumed was a plane coming down the Ohio River. Suddenly, they realized it was actually a very large bird. From their estimate, the object was 300 feet high and going around 70 miles per hour. The one thing that makes me hesitant calling this a Mothman sighting, though, was that they said it had a 4-foot-long neck. I don't like that.
A giraffe.
With wings.
It's just the Van Meter Visitor.
Oh my god. It's a crossover. Apologies to everyone hearing me just flip my fucking pages right now.
It's the ASMR section of the episode.
I need to stop cursing so much, even though we advertise it. Wedge decided that scene wasn't enough. He hopped into his plane and flew after it, but by the time he got in the air, the creature was gone. Now, this sighting is why a lot of people subscribe to the theory that Mothman was really just a sandhill crane. However, I do want to mention that this thing was going 70 miles per hour, while sandhill cranes tap out around 35 miles per hour. I know it's hard for people on the ground to judge the speed of aerial objects, but these were trained pilots. And if Wedge really is a supervillain, like you say, do you think he's going after Mothman and turn him into like a moth-themed weapon?
Maybe.
Do you think he's the billionaire in the moth suit?
Yeah, maybe he's Mothman. He was a pilot. That's a high-paying job.
Yeah.
He's the Mothman. It's settled. Series is over. It's Everett Wedge.
Occasionally, sightings would come in from beyond the Mothman's usual range. On December 6th, a mailman from Kentucky saw a creature matching the Mothman's description. He wrote in a letter to co-workers, quote, "I was on Washington train number 3, December 6th, and saw, quotations, Batman, heading down the Ohio River. He was just above Maysville, Kentucky, about 2:45. Was a darn big bird," end quote.
A darn big bird.
A darn big bird.
That's the most West Virginian sentence.
Darn big bird.
That's a darn big bird.
That darn big bird picked up some pepperoni rolls and he's on his way to a county fair.
I tried this one chili. It set my mouth on fire. Had to drink a 2-liter Mountain Dew. Saw this darn big bird up in the sky. That's
just... If we're from West Virginia, you can't get mad at us. It is worth noting that Maysville is just 2 hours from Point Pleasant, which I imagine isn't far if you're a flying creature. So, while not impossible, it is certainly farther than usual. Also on December 6th, busy day, a pair of adults would report seeing the Mothman in the TNT area. The description matched the typical appearance of gray feathers and red eyes. The next day, a group of 4 women saw the creature while driving on Ohio's Route 33. On the 8th, 2 women saw the creature atop a hill. A sighting came in on the 11th as Chester Liebert, an adult, was exploring the TNT area with Stevie Parson Jr., a 13-year-old boy. I just want to say that I have pretty sus written in my notes next to this encounter. According to newspaper reports, they're out looking for a Christmas tree. But again, they don't sound related. They have different last names. So again, pretty sus. Pretty Sussus Amogus, as some may say.
Dahmer.
We'll watch some Mothman prophecies and then you can leave. I haven't seen Dahmer. No one get mad at me, please. That same day, a woman named Catherine Beaver would report that the Mothman flew past her car on Route 35. At one point, a date was never specified. A woman named Loretta Faye Campbell spotted, quote, something, presumably the Mothman, flying high in the air before disappearing to the tree line. Just including this for completion's sake. I know it's not too compelling of a case. But what are you thinking so far? He's all over the place. Everyone's seen him.
He really is all over the place. I don't know. I feel like it is weird, like I said, that some people went hunting for Mothman. I find that to be strange, that he's one of the only cryptids that people are, like, not super afraid of. Like, we really embraced Mothman as a, you know, being in this state. And also, Beaver. Her last name is Beaver. These names sound fake. Who are these people?
You have to remember, West Virginia.
That's true. I have cousins named Hose Nose and Lou Buck, so I guess I really shouldn't be making fun of anyone's names.
What the fuck?
My family's weird, bro.
I mean, a lot of people go cryptid hunting. I mean, we had big parties looking out for the Grafton Monster, and we have, like, what, 27 different shows dedicated to finding just Bigfoot?
Okay, but Bigfoot is, like, I don't know if I consider him a cryptid, really.
What do you consider him?
I don't know, because, okay,
here's... A celebrity?
Yes.
Do you think he's a fucking ghost?
I don't know. Here's the thing about Bigfoot, though. Bigfoot is consistently seen in different areas throughout the country. I feel like in order to be a cryptid, there's one. That's it. There's not, like, a family of, you know, Mothman. There's not, like, a family of Van Meter visitors.
I disagree.
But there's,
the
like...
Owlman.
Okay.
From England.
I don't know if I consider him a cryptid either.
Just the Owlman? So, but the definition of a cryptid is a creature thought to exist but not scientifically proven. They never specify, like...
Yeah, I know, but, like, there's something about Bigfoot and, like, him being everywhere. Like, there's more than one Bigfoot, obviously. They're not in Canada and in Florida and in fucking West Virginia and then in Kansas. I don't know. But people all over the place report Bigfoot sightings. And, like, while Mothman gets reported in several different areas throughout the state of West Virginia and also, I think, in Ohio a few times, but, like, you know, it's, like, pretty clear that this is probably one being of this species, whereas, like, Bigfoot, there has to be more than one.
Yeah, but even if it's a species, it'd still be a cryptid. It'd be a cryptid species.
I don't know. I feel like there's a strange classification.
But we're not... This isn't the Bigfoot episode. I don't even know how we would handle that subject. Holy God.
Obviously, I would not handle it well, I think is the answer.
You'd just be like, no, this doesn't count. I can't do this.
This is not the cryptid code. This is the fucking Bigfoot code.
During all this, the TNT area was swarmed with countless people. Tourists, ufologists, and locals all gathered in droves to try and catch a glimpse of the Mothman. Almost 200 cars would be parked out there nightly. Among the visitors was a large number of hunters, armed to the teeth and determined to blast the Mothman right out of the sky.
Anyways, I started blasting.
Blasting. But while others patrolled the TNT area, desperate for the slightest glimpse of the Mothman, Linda Scarberry was regretting ever seeing it. Linda Scarberry is one of the first people to see it, by the way. She saw it with her husband, Roger, and their two friends, Steve and Mary Mallet. Just get you up to speed. After their encounter, Roger and her's trailer home become hosts of what appeared to be a poltergeist. They would be kept awake at night by near constant noise, namely loud beeps and words that sounded sped up, like a sped up video. Between this and the leftover anxiety of their encounter, the two eventually moved in with Park and Mabel McDaniel, Linda's parents. Not only did the activity continue, it escalated. More than just noises, they report the mysterious odor of a smoking cigar, as well as objects moving on their own.
Okay, so now we have a mob boss, Mothman ghost.
A moth boss?
Yes.
You come to me on the day of my caterpillar's wedding. You ask this of me. It's the godfather, the moth father.
Now I'm imagining an Italian Mothman.
It's mental illness, isn't it?
Yep, that's what keeps this podcast going.
Woo!
Woo! Yet the poltergeist wasn't the only thing to follow them. One December night, Linda looked out her window to see a man-like creature staring at her from a slanted bit of the house's roof.
Okay, so now we have a peeping Tom.
The Mothman had returned.
Peeping moth.
Normally, seeing the creature would cause people to fly into hysterics, but Linda didn't feel afraid. She felt slightly sad. She later reported that the Mothman looked cold, with his wings wrapped around his body as if trying to warm itself. In that moment, she saw the creature not as a menace or a monster, but as a lonely traveler, longing to connect. A bright spot would come into Linda's life with the birth of her baby, Danny, on December 25th, bringing a brief respite to the anxiety and fear. Strangely enough, on January 11th, Mabel McDaniel would have her own encounter with the Mothman. Around 5 p.m., she sighted the creature just above Tiny's restaurant, which has since been renamed Village Pizza. Thinking it was at first a plane, her daughter's story flashed into her mind, and she realized she was seeing the Mothman. It was gliding down Route 62, and Mabel remarked that she could see two legs dangling from it. Some have theorized that what she saw was a hand glider, but John Keel points out that the sport was very niche at the time. Plus, hand gliding over a well-traveled road sounds like a good way to end up a hood ornament. You know? That doesn't sound very safe to me.
No, no, not really.
If the wind hits you wrong, it's
And then you're roadkill.
Yeah.
And then...
And West Virginia is legal to eat roadkill, I think.
Yeah, it is.
I just found a loophole to cannibalism.
Oh my god, ew.
Now, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but for now, I don't want to talk about Mothman. Instead, we'll be turning back the clock to November 2nd, 1966, and talking about a man named Woodrow Derenberger. An appliance salesman in Mineral Wells, West Virginia, Derenberger was driving home after a long day of work on Interstate 77 near Parkersburg, around 7 p.m. Three sevens? Relevant? Maybe.
Angel numbers.
Angel and also a jackpot.
Woo!
Woo! Two vehicles were behind him, but he could only see their headlights. The first car passed him while the second approached. Realizing he was going over the speed limit, he worried the second vehicle was a police officer, so he began to slow down. Suddenly, the second vehicle also passed, then began to decelerate. It was then that Derenberger realized that it was not actually a car, but was instead a gray craft described as, quote, an old-fashioned kerosene lamp chimney, flaring at both ends, narrowing down to a small neck, then enlarging in a great bulge in the center. End quote. Don't you say anything. Don't you say a damn thing. This is a serious podcast. The object came to a gradual halt while also turning to block the road. Woodrow hit the brakes and stopped about a dozen feet from the craft. A door opened on a side, and a 5'10" tall figure emerged. In his headlights, Derenberger could see the figure's long dark coat. Though he could glimpse a green, sparkling garment underneath that appeared to be almost metallic. His skin was heavily tanned, but the feature that stood out the most was the giant, unmoving smile across his face. As the man approached the car, Derenberger heard him speak. "Roll down the window, please." The man spoke, but his ghoulish smile did not move. Instead, the word simply appeared within Derenberger's mind.
Oh my god, wait. We had another cryptid that did this.
Wait, what?
Oh my god, no. Oh no, that's the Fairmont Vegetable Man.
Ah.
That did that. He's like, "Don't be afraid," and then like sucks your blood in the middle of the woods. He's a little sucky sucky.
An episode, a topic for a different episode. The man was talking to him telepathically. "Do not be afraid. We mean you no harm." The figure asked for Derenberger's name. Woodrow gave his and asked the man for his name. And the man answered, "My name is Cold. I sleep, breathe, and bleed, even as you do." For the next few minutes, Cold asked Derenberger a series of questions. This included general questions like geography and politics, as if Cold was getting the lay of the land. He also asked what the lights in the distance were. Derenberger explained that it was Parkersburg, and that it was a city where people meet for commerce, work, and to live. In turn, Cold said that on his planet they're referred to as gatherings. While they spoke, Cold's craft hovered about 50 feet above the road, allowing traffic to pass. When they're done, Cold instructed Darren Berger to report his experience before getting to his craft and very quietly flying away. Woodrow would do exactly that and brought his story to the press. He would even give an interview on live TV the next day. After his interview, a number of people came forward to substantiate his claims. Multiple motorists claimed to have seen Darren Berger parked on the road conversing with a strange man. A few even saw the craft Cold had arrived in. One was Mrs. Frank Huggins, who witnessed the craft fly over the highway around the time Woodrow said it left.
Hmm.
Yeah, what do you think so far? It's not what you're expecting in a Mothman episode, right?
No, and it also very much reminds me of the Fairmont Vegetable Man.
Because of the telepathy?
The telepathy and kind of, like, I don't know. One of the names I feel like sounds familiar from when I was looking into the Vegetable Man to see if I could dig up enough for an episode. I don't know if we can, buddy. That'd be like...
Well, we could do like a two-parter where you do one crypt and I'll do mine. So like we can ease you in if you want.
I guess we could do that because there's not a whole lot about the Vegetable Man in general, like on his own. But I don't know. This really, really reminds me. Fucking Vegetable Man, which is probably just my ex-boyfriend, but, you know.
Yeah. But, yeah, a bit creepy, right?
It is creepy.
It's a smile. It's yeah. The fucking smile.
And, like, I don't know, I keep thinking about now that new, like, horror movie that came out called Smile, where, like, everyone's like, all of that, they can't see what I'm doing.
Yeah, very great for an audible medium, Jess. Very good. Yeah. We'll post her face on the Twitter.
No, we will not.
Yet this was not the only encounter Woodrow would have with Mr. Cold. On November 4th, Woodrow was driving with a coworker on Route 7. See, another 7, near Parkersburg. This time was different, however, as instead of seeing Cold, Darren Berger heard his voice in his head. Cold explained that he was a visitor from a distant world named Lanulos, which was in the Ganymede galaxy. It was similar to Earth in terms of fauna, flora, climate, and seasons. Lanulos differed, however, by being a utopia without war or poverty, an average life expectancy ranging from 125 to 175 years. Cold also gave some personal information. He told Darren Berger he was married to a female Lanulosian named Kimmy and had 2 sons. Hmm. Cold ended the conversation by warning Darren Berger that ending transmission would be very painful and to brace for it. Cold's voice faded away only to be replaced by a splitting migraine so bad Woodrow almost passed out. Kind of a dick move to do that while he's driving.
Right. That's horrible. Like, why not just wait till the poor man gets home and then, like, cut your telepathic communications off then?
Hello, Woodrow. I'm about to cut transmission. Good luck, fucker. Like, or he might not know.
Don't worry. It only hurt a lot.
2 weeks later, a pair of strangers arrived in Mineral Wells. The Mothman prophecies would describe them as such. Quote, one man was tall, blonde, and looked like a Scandinavian. His partner was short and slight, with pointed features and a dark olive complexion. They claimed to be salesmen. One house they would sell Bibles, the next, hardware. And occasionally they claimed to be Mormons on mission from Salem, Oregon, which faintly was having its own wave of UFO sightings at the time. Weirdly enough, their conversations never focused on their wares. They wanted to talk about Darren Berger. Repeatedly, they asked residents if they knew Woodrow and if they believed him. During all this, Darren Berger became a sort of reluctant celebrity. Woodrow's phone constantly rang off the hook. It eventually got so bad that he switched to an unlisted number. Despite this, the calls only got stranger. Some would consist only of beeps that he believed were Morse code, or people attempting to threaten him into silence. His house was sworn by excited ufologists as well as armed men who intended to shoot Cold upon his arrival. I don't know why that's the policy everywhere. This happened in the Van Meter Visitor. Everything slightly different gets gunned down.
Right.
The army of paranormal-minded poachers would not stop Cold's repeated visits. where eager onlookers watch the skies for that glowing craft. A clandestine black Volkswagen would discreetly pull into his driveway. Cole would get out and converse with Darren Berger before leaving, with the surrounding crowds none the wiser. On one particular occasion, Woodrow talked to Cole on his porch. He mentioned having stomach issues, and Cole handed him a vial of medicine that immediately cured the problem. It was only during one of these porch talks that Cole gave another small sliver of information. His first name was Indrid. Indrid Cole.
I wish somebody would give me a vial of medicine that would cure my fucking tummy issues.
No, you have to shit yourself forever.
That's so mean.
Yeah, welcome to life.
I have too many other problems to be worrying about shitting myself forever.
Oh, future Harmon, you have a lot of editing to do.
I'm sorry.
No, you're not. Woodrow's new stardom would be quite taxing, however, both on him as well as his family. Eventually, he decided to go to a doctor to receive psychiatric help to deal with the stress. He examined both by an EEG, predecessor to the modern CAT scan, technician named Peter Folardi, and one Dr. Morgan, not his real name, but a pseudonym given by John Keel in his book, for reasons that will become quite apparent. They gave Darren Berger a clean bill of health and concluded, quote, there was no evidence of abnormalities at all. Subsequently, a report and interpretation was obtained from Baltimore, and the report indicated no abnormalities at all and was a perfectly normal electrocephalogram. There was no evidence of organic brain damage or of seizure disorders. We were particularly concerned about epilepsy, but there was no evidence of this. The record was a normal record with no indication of any central nervous system pathology at all. There is no evidence of any psychiatric disorders. I submitted a report to the Pittsburgh Subcommittee of NITCA of the psychiatric exam of Mr. Darren Berger, in which I stated I could find no evidence of a mental disorder. There's no indication of any lower pathology. I found Mr. Darren Berger to be normal. End quote. I didn't expect to have to do that for so long. Sorry, guys. Said report will later be sent to the NICAP, NICAP, aka the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, a civilian research group dedicated to the study of UFOs. To make matters even weirder, Dr. Morgan would later receive his own telepathic messages from Indrid Cold that December. On February 21st, 1968, Woodrow Darren Berger would be interviewed by one Long John Nibble, a famous New York City radio host. I looked this guy up. He's legit. He actually has like a long-running radio show.
Yeah, he probably also has a long-running chain of restaurants.
During this interview, Dr. Morgan would be called live on air and repeat his claims. So what do you think about this? Like, even the psychiatrist had contacted Indrid Cold. And Darren Berger is found to have no abnormalities. So it's not a mental illness or anything. He did hallucinate this.
Supposedly. I don't know. I mean, the psychiatrist is like, oh yeah, I talked to him too. Which kind of makes it sound like, you know, you hear the expression, the blind leading the blind. We have the mentally ill trying to lead the mentally ill.
But yeah, it is an accredited doctor, so you have to give some, like, you know, credibility to it.
I guess.
I mean, it's... I find it compelling, personally.
Okay, but I had, like, an appointment with a psychiatrist the other day, and she was like, so, tell me about your life. Start at the beginning. Told her, like, pretty much my entire life story. This was, like, a consultation, you know, basically, to see if she could help me. And she was like, I don't know how you're alive, and I feel like you need 5 different appointments a week with 5 different therapists.
And now you just swore off all doctors ever.
Yeah, no, I'm like, fuck this.
In time, Woodrow will meet a number of other visitors from Lanulos. This include ones named Carlo Ardo and Demo Hassan. Woodrow's wife would also comment that she was unsettled by how human the Landalosians appeared, and how easily they could blend into society. One intriguing incident involves a man by the name of Jim Hackett, who was skywatching from his car with his cousin Darla Sarter near Bogle Ridge.
Why is he in the car with his cousin?
Stargazing.
That sounds like a date. West Virginia.
They spotted a series of white, green, and red lights that filled up the sky. Suddenly, there was a bright flash that seemed to shock Hackett with some kind of electricity. Still recovering from the shock, Hackett realized he was hearing a voice. Darla, however, heard nothing. A man holding a red light appeared next to their car and telepathically ordered him to step out. The strange man asked Hackett if Darla was his wife.
Yes.
Don't you say a damn thing. When Hackett explained she was his cousin, the man instructed her to stay in the car before leading Jim into the darkness. What happened next is unknown, but when Hackett returned, he was missing his shoes, socks, and his watch. He got mugged by a fucking alien. They took her to the alleyway, beat the shit out of him, took his shoes, took his Yeezys, his Rolex watch, his fucking socks.
They took his Gucci slides. I guarantee. And his Tissot.
They didn't mention it, but I'm pretty sure they would have taken his wallet too.
Yeah, I feel like, yeah, who just wants shoes, socks, and the watch? Is that like your club fit?
Come here, Xanos. These earthlings have the drip.
Ew.
No drip, like fancy gloves.
I know.
I'm hip.
I know what you mean, but also saying like, all these humans have the drip. I'm just like, oh, God, no we don't.
According to the Mothman prophecies, quote, Jim and Carla visited Woody the next day, and the contactee accompanied them to the same spot on Bogle Ridge that night. Injured cold, Carlo Ardo and Demo Hassan were waiting for them. Woody explained what happened, and a spaceman said Hackett had encountered, quote, humanoids, who are no good thieves. He was lucky he had lost only his shoes, socks, and watch, but they would run the culprits down and recover the items they promised.
You're lucky they only stole your fucking Yeezys and Rolex, motherfucker.
One wrong move, you would have woken up in a motel in a bathtub covered in ice with a kidney missing.
Were they Hanes socks? We need to know the brand so we can recover them properly.
They took my Supreme shirt. The next day, when Jim stepped out his door to pick up the morning paper, he was surprised to find his shoes neatly shined and sitting on the step with laundered socks and the watch inside. End quote.
So he was mugged and then by an alien, and then the alien was like, okay, I better take care of these before I give them back.
No, Indra and his buddies went to get it back for him.
Yeah, but why wouldn't they just knock and, like, give it back?
Because they had to keep the mystique.
This is such a man thing to do.
It's nice.
It's nice, but it's also, like, this is what men do. Men are like, here you go,
stealing Gucci's.
Yeah, men are like, I'm going to go get your socks back. Like, it's a pair of socks and a pair of shoes and a watch. Like, I don't give a shit. I don't need it back if someone stole it. And it's like, oh, don't worry. We'll hunt down that motherfucker.
Well, I mean, like, the watch is probably pretty expensive.
I mean, the watch maybe, but, like, and even the shoes maybe. But also, like, those are items if someone borrowed from me, I don't know where you've been. I don't want the socks back.
Well, they were laundered. Does that help?
No.
Okay, fine. Fucking galactic level laundry isn't good enough for you. God. Ungrateful earthlings. While many were content to write Darren Berger off as a simple loony looking for a quick buck, it appears his story is taken seriously by some pretty serious people. Sometime later, in December or early January, Durenberger and his family were flown out to Cape Kennedy, Florida, at the behest of one Bruce Parsons. That's significant because That's significant because Cape Kennedy is home to the NASA space program, and Captain Bruce Parsons was an officer in its security branch. Supposedly, Durenberger and his family spent the week touring the incredible facilities. Yet, he also extensively was questioned at night about his encounters with Indra Cold. One thing he said had a particularly disturbing implication. This excerpt is from the Mothman Prophecies and reads thus. Quote, they said they had interviewed several other contactees, all with stories similar to my own. When he asked why they didn't release their UFO information to the public, they allegedly replied that it would only cause panic. Women would commit suicide, throw babies out the window, and this kind of panic would sweep the world, they said. Oh, end quote. Yeah, a little fucked up, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, what are your thoughts thus far? This seems to have taken a bit of a turn.
No, this is so strange. All these people are like, oh yes, this alien, this very nice man, this very nice alien man, he contacts me. Occasionally he steals shoes and socks and watches.
I think it's someone else who stole the shoes.
Still.
Cold had to get it back.
Yeah. Susan. Okay, right, that's true. Okay, so like, a different alien, maybe not as cultured, stole the shoes. And then, you know, Cold was like, all right, let me go get your shoes for you, buddy. I'm sorry. I'm sorry one of my people did that. Like, he seems very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. I feel like, you know, if he can live in peace with us and, like, be happy, fine. Whatever. Good for him.
Yeah, I'm more concerned about women committing suicide and throwing babies out the window.
Yeah, I feel like this is, like, one of those reactions everyone has about everything. Like, I don't know. It's like, Y2K.
Well, I'm thinking,
like, everyone had, like, people are like, dude, why are there so many fucking 23-year-olds right now? And it's like, because everyone thought the world was gonna end in 2000.
Hear me out. It seems to me like there's always this big, like, conspiracy in the UFO community of, like, hybrids, star children, humans and aliens kind of mixing together. Do you think it's something like that? Like, subtly take over mankind? Because they said they're good enough to sneak into society, to blend in.
Okay. This is probably the wrong way to look at this. From a biological perspective, if speciation has occurred, you cannot mate, regardless. So if the aliens are actually a fully blown different species than us, we can't have hybrids. It doesn't work. So biologically, if they are actually all that different from us, we would not be able to produce any children with them unless they have invented some sort of technology in order to do so, which maybe they have, fine, whatever. But
what if we're from Lanulos originally?
Maybe we are.
Wouldn't that be something? I think the Star Child thing is something to keep in mind as we go forward.
Like that guy from Kiss.
What?
Oh my god. You're so uncultured.
They have names?
Yes. There's Star Child, there's Catman. Gene okay, Simmons, I think, names. Is like the devil or something. And then there's another one. I don't know.
This isn't the Kiss Code. But this raises some interesting questions. What are the humanoids? Are they a race separate from the Lanulosians? Or as I like to call them, the Grinning Men? Is Cold altruistic, or is his apparent compassion an attempt to endear himself to Woodrow? And what exactly do they want? Now your next question may very well be, Harmon, what the fuck does this have to do with Mothman? And I'm pretty sure that's what you've been wondering the whole episode.
I'm not quite there yet. I'm like, this has to tie in somewhere, right?
Yes. You see, Indra Cold is indicative of a wider phenomenon that will plague Point Pleasant from 1966 to 1967. as the Mothman stalked the skies above, an army of black Cadillacs and sunglass agents would watch from the shadows. Their two mythologies would become irreversibly fused to the point you can't imagine one without the other. Endrick Holt, or many like him, would make repeated appearances in Point Pleasant, with their eerie aspects and sinister smiles gaining them the moniker of the Grinning Men. But you may know them more colloquially as the Men in Black. Yeah, boy. The first connection between the Mothman and the MIB beyond geographic proximity would be the MIB's penchant for targeting witnesses of the winged creature. In early December, Marcella Bennett, she saw the Mothman in the TNT area, almost killed her baby, was driving home on a back road when a red Ford Galaxy, of course an alien would drive a Galaxy.
For real.
Sped up behind her. She noted the large man driving the truck was, quote, wearing a very bushy fright wig, like one of those fake wigs you can get like Party City, mm-hmm. I assume.
Was he also wearing a Vote for Pedro shirt?
It's time to sell from the room. It's bullshit. I did not need that. I did not. Marcella slowed down in the hopes that the car would simply pass her. Instead, it sped up, bumping her rear end and nearly forcing her off the road. Failing that, the Ford pulled into the other lane and sped in front of her. When it reached the bend, it swerved sideways to block the road. But, like a badass, Marcella didn't slow down. She sped up. It was an intense game of chicken, hiding by her young daughter Tina's presence in the back seat. But Marcella knew this man meant no harm, and stopping was almost certainly death. Pressing the gas for all it'd give, she tunneled towards the makeshift roadblock with frightening speed. And at the last second, the driver pulled off the road and she shot past him. Yeah.
What a badass.
I know, right?
Good for her.
Girl boss moment.
Yeah.
These agents of Audi would be seen again in January 1967, when a strange man arrived late one night to Mary Heyer's office. He was 4'6", manlet, with an inch added by his thick-soled shoes.
Oh my god, it's Brad.
Just continue listening. He also wore a blue short-sleeved shirt and blue pants. Despite the frigid temperatures of a West Virginia winter, he lacked any jacket or coat. The fringes of his long, bowl-cut black hair, so it was like a runaway beetle, contrasted his pale skin. His deep-set eyes stared intensely at Mary through a pair of thick-rimmed glasses. She would later say, quote, he kept getting closer and closer, his funny staring eyes at me almost hypnotically. The stranger asked for directions to Welch, West Virginia, then proceeded to give an overly complicated, long-winded explanation of how he hitchhiked all the way from Detroit to Point Pleasant after his car broke down. It's worth noting that's a 5-hour trip.
What the fuck is in Welch?
I have no idea. Like jam or something?
Nothing. There's nothing. I can guarantee you it's like a post office.
A post office? And this is a like, sheets?
No, I don't even think it's a sheet. No. A post office in a sheets is Philippi. So this
and mummies.
Well, those are like, you know, the one thing that they have there.
And a covered bridge.
And a covered bridge. But also, like, Welch, I'm pretty sure, is just a post office and, like, a population of two people, and they both work in the post office.
Do you want to go there sometime? Do some in-the-field investigation?
Why would I want to go to a post office as a field trip?
I meant Welch. I know, I repeat myself. But that could be an even longer trip if he was hitchhiking. When he spoke, he had a peculiar speech impediment, as if the words were unfamiliar. Mary, frightened by the man's erratic behavior, retreated to the back room and got her circulation manager to accompany her. As the conversation went on, the man picked up a ballpoint pen and marveled over the object as if it was foreign or alien to him. Mary offered to let him keep it. The stranger responded by letting out an odd little cackle, then quickly sprinting out the office. Mary called all the local mental hospitals to see if a patient had escaped, and they all report none were missing. Just
as if they would know.
As if they would know. That's a good point. I also just love the mental image of just taking a pen, going like, and then leaving. The most frightening encounter would be with poor, unfortunate Connie Carpenter. Since her last run with the Mothman, she left so shaken that she moved to Middleport, Ohio, with her now husband, Keith. On February 22nd, at 8:15 a.m., Connie was walking to school. A black 1949 Buick pulled up beside her. The driver described as looking about 25. Clean cut, and wearing a colorful mod shirt without jacket. He also had dark, tanned skin, similar to that of Indra Cold. The man opened his door and asked for Connie for directions. When she approached to answer him, the man snatched her arm and tried to pull her into the car. She managed to break his grip and ran as quick as she could back home. Once in the safety of her home, she locked all the doors and stayed away from the windows until Keith returned. Still freaked out, she decided to stay home the next day, but at 3 a.m., she heard a knock on her front door. Hesitantly, she opened it and found nothing there, save a note that read, "Be careful, girl. I can get you yet."
Ew!
Yeah, that's probably the freakiest thing. That's icky. I don't like it. The incident was reported to the police, specifically one Raymond Manley.
What the fuck?
His last name is Manley, of course I had to say it like that.
Manley.
Just got done having a man witch.
Toxic masculinity.
A month later, John Keel checked into the progress the police had made finding the culprit. The note left on her doorstep had since disappeared, and the file of the case consisted of one sheet of paper with Connie's name, her address, and a single line reading, "Dark Buick, young man." Soon after, Connie and Keith moved back to West Virginia. However, these MIBs were appearing all over the country and seemed to have a vested interest in the paranormal. I don't want to stray too far off the Mothman path, so most of the MIB stuff I'll save for their own respective episode. What I will say is that they often had the guise of Air Force officials, such as Major Richard French, a particularly notorious MIB who silenced UFO witnesses. Mm-hmm. The problem was so prevalent that the Pentagon supposedly commented on it. The following is an excerpt from the Mothman prophecies from a confidential letter sent from the Pentagon on February 15th, 1967, though I've yet to find an original copy. Information has reached headquarters USAF that persons claiming to represent the Air Force or other defense establishments have contacted citizens who have sighted unidentified flying objects. In one reported case, an individual in civilian clothes who represented himself as a member of NORAD demanded and received photos belonging to a private citizen. In another, a person in an Air Force uniform approached local police and other citizens who had sighted a UFO, assembled them in a schoolroom, and told them they did not see what they thought they saw, and they should not talk to anyone about their sighting. All military and civilian personnel, and particularly information officers and UFO investigating officers who hear of such reports, should immediately notify the local OSI, Office of Special Investigations, offices. Signed, Hewitt T. Wheelis, Lieutenant General, United States Air Force, Assistant Vice Chief of Staff.
That's not a real name either. There's no way.
I looked it up. He is a real dude.
That's insane.
Hewitt T. Wheelis. Now, what could have brought these MIBs to Point Pleasant? Of course, they could be interested in the Mothman. But are they allies covering his tracks? Is the Mothman in league with the MIBs? Or are they attempting to hunt and contain the creature? Yet, even with Poltergeist, the Mothman, and the Grinning Men, we do not have the full picture of the paranormal phenomenon occurring in Point Pleasant. In truth, there's a third set of activity we need to factor in. The abundance of UFO sightings in the Ohio River Valley at this time. Mrs. Roy Groyce lived directly across the Ohio River from the TNT area. On November 17, 1966, she was woken up around 4:45 a.m. to the sound of her dog barking. She went to investigate and, looking out her kitchen window, saw a floating circular object the size of a small house in a field near Route 7. It was hovering just above the treetops and glowed brilliant red and green lights. She watched it for a few moments before it zigzagged away before disappearing. There was a series of sightings on December 8th. About 2 a.m., an anonymous young man spotted a floating, glowing circular object just above the Ohio River. He noted that it had windows with blinds that resembled aluminum foil. What's so funny about that? Are you not taking this seriously, Jessica?
You're
a very serious podcast.
I don't know. It just sounds like in Monsters, Inc., like right now. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
The scene? Oh my god, So, kids aren't allowed in the monster world, right? They think they're toxic. Like, if they touch them, it'll kill the monsters, whatever. So it's like, the kid got into the monster world and it like got out in the monster restaurant, and then one of the monsters is being interviewed by the fucking monster police outside or whatever, like the monster news. There's like helicopters flying over and everything, and he's like, "That child, I saw it myself. He picked me up with its laser vision and shook me like a dog." And that's very much what I'm thinking of when this guy's like, "It has tinfoil blinds." Anyway.
Are you disparaging my witnesses?
No, I'm just...
It feels like you're disparaging my witnesses. Is this a joke to you, God. Jessica?
Harmon. Yes.
I worked really hard on this.
I know. Okay, I'm not saying it's a joke, but also at the same time, it's just a joke. Like, these people, the shit they fucking come up with when they're talking about this stuff, it's wild.
What do you mean come up with? It happened. There it is. In black and white.
We've already
in the script I wrote.
Already, have I talked to you about how eyewitness testimony is the absolute least accurate form of testimony, other than like bite mark evidence? This is like you can't trust what people say because traumatic events, our brain blocks stuff out. So then we try and fill in the gaps and we come up with dumb shit like fucking aluminum foil blinds.
I don't like this.
Set my mouth on fire, had to drink a 2-liter Mountain Dew.
2 hours later, Mr. and Mrs. Hearn saw either the same thing or a very similar object at their home in Cheshire, Ohio, not far from the TNT area. Mr. Charles Hearn was walking their dog when they saw a red light across the river. He initially thought it was a boat on the water, but instead hovered right over the riverbank. Charles shouted for his wife to come...
I'm so sorry.
No worries. Charles shouted for his wife to come see it too, and she joined him shortly after. Peering into the bright light, they could make out figures moving in the light's glare. They woke up their neighbors, the Tylers, to see it as well. The object flashed red and orange, with one beam directed at the water. Abruptly, lights faded only to be replaced with a greenish glow, and the object rose directly upwards and vanished. So you have to, at least it's multiple people seeing it.
Fair. Okay. Fine.
Yeah. And generally the details are coming together.
Yeah, but no one else said fucking aluminum foil blinds.
That's what you're going to get hung up on.
I guess.
Hung up like blinds.
I feel like...
Particularly aluminum foil ones.
Every episode there's something dumb I get hung up on, right?
I don't know.
I feel like anyone who has listened to any of the podcast episodes where I'm speaking, it's like, God damn it, this dumb fucking bitch.
You're imagining our audience is very crude.
I feel like they are very aggressive towards me. I don't know why. I feel like everyone hates me.
It's a social anxiety.
Yeah.
It's a mental illness, isn't it?
I have a disorder. Or 7.
You know who doesn't? Woodrow Derenberger. He went to a doctor. Matt Jones is far from the popular image of UFO witnesses as unkept, unhinged individuals paranoidly watching the skies, like me. He was a respectable appliance store manager from Dunbar, a quaint little suburb in Charleston. On January 19th, as he was driving on Route 64, roughly 10 miles out of Charleston, the time was 9:05 a.m. As he made his way down the long, lonely stretch of road, he noticed a large object blocking the road. At first, he thought it was construction equipment, but realized quickly that it was hovering 4 feet off the ground. Quote, it was a large metal sphere. Since it was broad daylight, I got a very good look at it. It was about 20 feet in diameter and was the color of dull aluminum. There were four legs attached to it with caster-like wheels on the bottoms of each one. And there was a small window about 9 inches in diameter on the side facing me. But I couldn't see anything inside the sphere. On the underside, there was something like a propeller. It was idling when I first drove up. Then it started spinning faster, and the whole object began to rise upward. It disappeared into the sky, and I drove onto my store. End quote. God, I can't imagine going to work after something like that.
Yeah.
If I'm driving to work and see, like, E.T.'s trailer home, I'm calling off for the day. Are you okay?
E.T.'s trailer home?
I don't know. He's living out of his UFO. He's having hard times right now.
Yeah.
Don't be judgmental. The royalty's dried up. Jones, of course, reported this to both the police and the press. He's ready to put the incident behind him. He received a note slid under his door the next day. It read, quote, we know what you have seen, and we know that you have talked. You better keep your mouth shut, end quote. He assumed it was a prank and paid not much mind to it, until a few days later when he received a second, this time made of cardboard. It repeated the threat, but with the addition of, quote, there won't be another warning. I think they meant won't, but whatever. A week later, Jones passed the location where he saw the object and spotted a man standing right in the exact same spot. The witness described him as, quote, he was very tan, or his face was very flushed. He looked normal and was wearing a blue coat and a blue cap with a visor. Something like a uniform, I guess. I noticed he was holding a box in his hand. Some kind of instrument. It had a large dial on it, like a clock. And a wire ran from it to his other hand, end quote. He stopped to ask if the man needed a ride, and he simply smiled at him and waved. Jones would see him the very next day as well. Keel found that a gas line went through the exact spot where he had witnessed the man. He also asked the local gas company if they had any maintenance men or some employee walking on that day, but they confirmed no one was out at that time.
Strange.
Keel and Heyer would investigate the spot in person and discover some odd things. This included animal tracks that resembled a dog, but local experts could not identify it. A single, naked, human footprint, and footprints that resembled the tread of ripple-soled shoes with a ridge around the edges. Much to their frustration, the tracks never led anywhere, and in fact, never seemed to start anywhere either.
So they're just random footprints in the middle of the woods? Like, yeah. In the middle? Like, there's nothing. There's no trail. It's just...
It's on, I assume, along the side of the road. But it's just kind of directionless, if that makes sense.
It's so strange.
In 1969, Keel would see a photograph of footprints that appeared strikingly similar to the ones he found along Route 64. I actually have that photo right here. Would you like to see it?
Of course.
Do you know what that is?
It looks like a moon boot.
It's the first footprint left on the moon by the Apollo lunar landing. Yeah. Recall the conspiracy theorist Heyer interviewed and his fear that man's interest in the moon would bring something alien back to Earth. And also NASA's connection to this. Isn't it just a bit weird? NASA said they already knew about Andrew Cold and suddenly where someone seen something very similar to him. Astronaut boots?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird. It's gonna get weirder.
How could it not?
This encounter allows us to draw a strong connection between the olive-skinned grinning men and the UFOs that would fill the skies of the Mountain State. With the appearance of men in black and strange lights, there also come an array of phenomena, typically tied to extraterrestrial activity. One of the grimmest was the unexplained death of animals in the Point Pleasant area. Not only does one have to consider the unfortunate fate of Merle's German Shepherd Bandit, but shortly after the Scarberry Mallet sighting, the police discovered the body of a dog in the TNT area. Disturbingly, the creature had been burned to a crisp, yet the area around it had no sign of fire damage.
Ew.
This morbid find has led some to speculate that the creature was a sacrifice performed by cultists, and that the TNT area was host to demonic rituals that had broken the walls between realities, allowing the Mothman and his ilk to slip into our world.
Isn't that just the plot of Stranger Things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except more Cold War science than animal sacrifice. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that? Do you think Mothman's a demon?
No.
I don't buy it either. Because I feel like if he was pure evil, he would have fucked up a lot more people by now.
Yeah, for sure. God, I also feel like that one lady, she was like, oh, he looks cold. Like he's wrapping himself in his wings. He looks cold and afraid and scared outside by himself. Like, and now I just imagine this, like, cute little moth boy, like, you know, like, all wrapped up. And I don't know. Like,
I'm
I feel
used
like,
to the fires of hell. This is very cold.
Yeah, but also I feel like demons don't really get cold, do they? They're just, like, pissed. Like, they don't care.
They're just mad.
They're just mad. They don't care about anything. Like, they...
True.
Like, they don't care if they're cold. They don't get hot, cold, anything like that. They're just, like...
There.
Ha, blah, blah. I've come to murder you.
What the... What?
I don't know.
Why did that sound like almost Bela Lugosi? Blah, blah, I've come to murder you.
I don't know. That's how I imagine demons, just weirder vampires.
More deaths would come, though, as a wave of cattle mutilations began to pop up around West Virginia. Keel wrote, quote, Throughout the Ohio River Valley, dogs, cows, and horses were dying suddenly and mysteriously, usually from surgical-like incisions in their throats. Animal disappearances and deaths go hand-in-hand with UFO phenomenon. The most puzzling aspect of these deaths is the absence of blood. Often the carcasses seem drained of all blood. The wounds don't bleed. No blood is in evidence in the grass or dirt where the victims lie. Among my grimmer memories of 1966 to 67 are those times I knelt in farm fields to examine dead animals, particularly dogs, who would suffer amazingly clean and expert cuts. End quote.
Ew.
Yeah.
I don't like this.
Yeah, I was thinking of doing a deep dive into the history of cow mutilations, but I don't know if that's too morbid.
I feel like it is a little sketchy.
Sketchy. An example would come from a professional woman who later interviewed. I don't know what's wrong with me. I know I can read, I promise, but I'm fucking struggling. An example would come from a professional woman who would later be interviewed by Keel in April of that year under the fake name Mrs. Bryant. She said, quote, last November, I think it was the 2nd or the 3rd, I was out behind this building, getting ready to go home. It was 7 or 8 o'clock. Suddenly, there was a little flash gun going off directly above me. And then I saw a thing, some kind of flying machine. I couldn't move. I was frozen with fright. This thing landed right there in the parking lot, not 20 feet away from me. It was a big cylinder. Anyway, it didn't make the slightest bit of noise. It just drifted down and I stopped. Like I say, I couldn't move. I guess I started praying. Then two men came out of it, and they walked over to me. End quote. I don't know why I made her, like, British. Like a British nanny.
I don't know, but I love it because there's this woman on TikTok right now, and that voice reminded me of her.
Shout out, woman on TikTok. I hope you're doing well out there.
She makes these really bizarre videos where she's like,
One time, I heard of this thing called Happy Hour, and really, it should be called Sad Hour, but I had my helicopter fly me to the roof of something called an Applebee's, which is not apples nor bees, but they have dollar drinks. I ordered a Long Island iced tea, which is a very gross drink made of very many other gross drinks. Yeah, it's great. It's like this rich woman, you know, like... doing poor people shit, like what happened.
And then she puts on her Mothman costume to terrorize the locals. She described them as having tanned faces with pointed features and wearing overalls. Their voices were high-pitched as they asked her questions such as her name, general knowledge of the area, and the time, which they asked for repeatedly. It was not until the men left that she was finally able to move. Altogether, very similar to Darren Berger's encounter with Indra Cold. She was content to leave the issue alone, but what drove her to report her experience was seeing the same men again in downtown Gallipolis, Ohio. Gallipolis, I have been told it's called, but whatever. Blending in perfectly with the human population. So there we go again. It's like a silent invasion. Hmm. Kind of like body snatchers, pie people, right?
Ew. Yeah, it is.
This was not Mrs. Bryant's only run-in with the paranormal. Her farm, located on the outskirts of town, was plagued with a series of cow mutilations between 1963 and 1964. Disturbingly, her cows were found often missing a gore warning, by the way, guys. Their eyeballs, udders, internal organs, and even their brains.
Chrissy, wake up.
I don't like this. She even caught the killers in the act several times, described as tall men in white overalls that moved with incredible speed. She attempted to chase them down but found they had escaped by jumping over a fence in a single bound. Soon after, her farmhouse burned to the ground. She managed to rebuild, but strange things continued. One night, she was woken up by an intense heat. Just like before, Mrs. Bryant was paralyzed, helplessly watching as a tall, dark figure entered the room through a door with two separate locks, then proceeded to exit out another locked door. However, I will admit this could be a case of sleep paralysis. Other weird happenings include metallic footsteps on the roof, the phone leaving familiar beeping noises, and the appearance of craft passing over our house that her teenage son called flying boxcars.
Wow, her teenager sounds like he had the vocabulary of a 6-year-old.
Leave the kid alone. UFOs weren't... Actually, yeah, UFOs were pretty big at that time. I don't know. How would you describe, like, a flying boxcar?
I don't know, but not as a flying boxcar.
So easy to criticize.
Oh, God, I just want to bully these people, okay?
We have to be nice, or else witnesses won't talk to us anymore.
They don't talk to us. They talk to other people, and we steal the research.
It's called sighting research. The cow mutilations would seem to imply that extraterrestrials have a fascination with blood. One case out of Huntington has even graver implications. On March 5, 1967, a Red Cross bloodmobile was driving on Route 2 full of blood donations. On board, Bew Scherzer, age 21, and an anonymous nurse were making their way towards Huntington. On one side was a thick woods, with long shadows cast by swaying trees. On the other, the Ohio River, its glossy, dark surface gleaming in the moonlight like an obsidian mirror. Suddenly, Search was blinded by a flash of brilliant light. He managed to stay on the road, but when it faded, he saw a white, glowing orb on a nearby hill. It was flying towards them. The nurse screamed for him to go faster, and Search didn't have to be told twice. He stomped on the gas pedal, but the orb kept pace, hovering just above them. Search poked his head out the driver window and saw a pincer-like arm coming out of the orb and attempting to snatch the truck. Another light appeared on the road, headlights of an oncoming car. Perhaps wanting no witnesses, the craft simply retracted its arms and disappeared into the night sky.
Nice. Slick move.
A few nights later, Point Pleasant police officer Harold Harmon would spot another craft within the TNT area. He wrote, quote, "It was definitely a salt machine of some kind. I could even see what appeared to be windows in it. It rocked unevenly like a boat hitting waves, and it floated silently away over the trees," end quote. "And I saw the blinds. Aluminum foil."
Tinted windows.
Tinted windows. But yeah, what do you think of the blood thing? I feel like this might be playing into the hybrid stuff, you know?
Yeah. Kinky.
Gotta get that human DNA.
What if they're just vampires? It's just like Edward Cullen on a fucking UFO.
Carlisle!
This is the skin of a killer, Woodrow.
Welcome to the Twilight Code. Not long after, three strangers with dark complexions and tan skin were spotted wandering the streets of Point Pleasant, supposedly selling magazine subscriptions, though they never said what magazines. They were always on foot, but despite this, bless you.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
I've sneezed like 3 times in this episode.
Don't worry about it, my dude. Seemingly managed to continually evade the police. However, we do have a case where someone interacted with a strange man. In the second week of March, Mabel McDaniel was visited by one of them while working at the unemployment office. He was dressed in all black and claimed to have visited Mary Heyer's office, although she denied ever meeting the man. When he spoke, his words were slurred and unsteady as if he was drunk. Mabel described it as, quote, "very dark, and his English was so poor I never really did figure out what he wanted. His eyes were funny looking, kind of starey and glassy. From what I could get from him, he was looking for an insurance company. Only kept saying he wanted trip insurance," end quote. Now, one last thing I do want to mention is that recently I went to the Mothman Festival. Shout out to Point Pleasant. And it was really fun. It was really, really fun. But there I actually met an author who actually said he would be willing to come on the show at some point. So let's see if we can make that happen. But what I really want to talk about is his book, Eerie Appalachia, which is like a collection of different spooky stories that are supposedly true from Appalachia, and includes a chapter on Indra Cold. Hmm. And why I bring this up is because he found a case from Florida where a class of children saw a UFO over the Tampa Bay, and one of the boy's fathers noted that his son was visited by three men. Now, he had the two names of the Air Force officers, which I can't recall right now, but the third guy was what really caught his interest, because he didn't have a rank. He wasn't associated with any branch. He is listed simply as Government Man Cold. Yeah. And according to the boy's testimony, Cold never spoke during the entire interrogation. Hmm. He just stared at the kid and smiled.
I feel like when I was looking, I know I keep going back to
God.
I know I keep going back to the Vegetable Man. I'm pretty sure someone had the last name Cold in that whole thing, too.
I'll look it up.
Like 90% sure. I swear to God I've heard this name before and I can't remember where, but I feel like it's the Vegetable Man.
Well, if a vegetable's name is Cold,
then it's Indrid.
He's a vegetable pretending to be a man. No, the guy who saw the Vegetable Man was Jennings Frederick. I don't know where you're getting Cold from.
I don't know. There's got to be something else. I swear to God there's been another episode where we had someone named Cold or something. Or maybe it was just, was it UFO night?
Yes, here? I mentioned UFO night.
Yes. Yeah, maybe that's where I'm coming up with the Vegetable Man and Cold being associated.
But as you can see, this case goes far deeper than just the Mothman. While he is the icon of Point Pleasant's paranormal outbreak, we have UFOs, men in black, poltergeists, all topped off with one of America's most famous cryptids. And we haven't even gotten to the bulk of UFOs that had quickly descend upon the small, humble West Virginian town. But for now, what are your thoughts on what's going on? Where's your head at? You have Mothman flying around, we have UFOs, we got Men in Black.
This state is cursed, is my thought that's going on. We have a cryptid for just about every fucking town in the state. We've had the Men in Black, we have the FBI raiding normal people's houses. I don't know. This is all very strange. This state, there's something weird here.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, like, so the Telltale Lilac Bush is like a collection of ghost stories. Mm-hmm. Most of those occur within, like, Marion County, which is where I'm from. And I feel like there's something about this state, like, we have a portal or something to, like, hell or space or I don't know what. But there's got to be a reason why we always have so much going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's always something here.
Well, it's funny you should say curse, because actually one of the theories from Mothman is that he was summoned by a curse of a murdered Native American chief called Chief Cornstalk, who was killed sometime after the Battle of Point Pleasant. He was captured, he was a political prisoner, and they executed him. Him and his sons. And supposedly, his last words were that Point Pleasant would be haunted and cursed. And one thing I learned while at the Mothman Festival was the memorial they put up for the Point Pleasant battle had to be put up 3 separate times. The first 2 times, it was struck by lightning and broke. The second time was literally immediately after they put it up. Like, the crane was still attached, and lightning struck it.
That's insane.
Yeah, I know, right? So, but what do you think? Do you think the MIB are working with Mothman, or are they trying to contain him? Like, where's your head at with that?
I don't know. Part of me wants to say, like, they know about him. Maybe they are just trying to contain him. But then there's the Indrid stuff. And, so, I just don't know, like, I can't quite, like, wrap my head around a decision, I guess, with that, on whether or not they're trying to help or, like, contain. Like, if they're trying to help Mothman or just contain it so it doesn't get farther than it's already been. I do, like, kind of believe that the Men in Black was, like, this kind of weird government agency that was just, you know, built to cover shit up. So at that point, I would argue they're probably just trying to cover it up.
But on the flip side, they don't seem to be human.
Right.
I think these guys are the Landalogians, that they're working with Andrew Cold. And while we're talking about Andrew Cold, where's your head with him?
I don't know.
Because do you think he's a good guy? Bad guy?
Cause I do kind of think he's a good guy. I don't want to sit here. Like, he never really hurt anybody, like, other than, you know, giving you splitting fucking migraines when he has to detach from you. But he never hurt anybody. He doesn't seem like a bad guy. It seems like he genuinely was trying to help people. Maybe he was kind of attempting to contain things a little more because he was afraid of his secrets getting out.
But on the flip side, he looks very much like these Men in Black appearing throughout town.
Yeah.
And one that looks very similar to him. I can't say if it's the same one, but with that dark complexion, tried to kidnap Connie.
Yeah, that's so true.
It's like, it's almost, this is why the Mothman mystery is so intriguing when you get into the weeds of it, because it sounds like just a simple cryptid, but you look more into it, it's all this stuff that you can't really make sense of.
I mean, I feel like when it comes down to it, there's so much on Mothman that honestly this could have been like a 15 part series, you know? Like, there's enough shit out there that you could turn this into, like, I mean, there's books and there's movies and there's TV series and everything that have to do with Mothman, but when you get deeper into it, it's like West Virginia specifically, like, has tons of stuff surrounding it. So either we are all fucking nuts, or
the state is cursed.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what the bigger picture is, and I want to tell you it's going to get simpler, but that'd be a fucking lie.
Of course.
And if you feel rushing air, it's because we're tumbling down a rabbit hole, and we have yet to reach the bottom. But as we follow Kiel's investigations and piece the clues together, we might start to get a true grasp on the scope of this phenomena. However, that'll have to wait until next time. And if you want to join us as we delve deeper into this case, subscribe and follow. You can follow our Twitter at The Cryptic Code. And if you like what you hear, consider leaving a good review on our Apple page. But for now, watch out for men in black suits. Don't put up monuments to defeats of Native American tribes. And most of all, stay spooky out there.